Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the primary elections in Arizona, Missouri, Michigan in particular yesterday, and of course the Kansas ballot question on abortion. Trump had a pretty good night. Blake Masters winning the Republican nomination to face Mark Kelly in Arizona. Carrie Lake, the Republican candidate for governor, Trump backed. Too close to call, but she does enjoy a narrow lead at the moment.
Yeah, she's with Karen Taylor Robeson. Remember, she was backed by Pence. Pence was out in Arizona campaigning.
Pence and, more importantly, Ducey.
Yeah, and Governor Ducey, the retiring governor of Arizona. But that's going to be a close one. It's still...
She's got a 9,000 vote lead with about 80% of the vote in. Dixon, Tudor Dixon in Michigan. Trump endorsed late, sort of when the race was already over, in my estimation. But nonetheless, he'll count that as a win. And that's the candidate he backed in the Michigan GOP primary to face the Eva Perón of East Lansing, their Whitmer and her FBI friends. In Michigan, Pete Meyer. Pete Meyer.
The incumbent who voted to impeach Trump.
Correct. Freshman. Lost to impressive candidate. You know, this is the interesting thing. You hear the characterizations of Trump-backed candidates or candidates challenging the establishment that are then endorsed by Trump. Trump administration veterans who then run for office, like Gibbs, John Gibbs, who ran against Pete Meyer. You know, this John Gibbs, who worked for HUD under Trump, computer science degree from Stanford.
Yeah, Stanford.
MPA from Harvard. Worked for Apple. Also has done some missionary work. He converted to Catholicism. He observes the Latin Mass. I mean, and, you know, I hate playing this, but I'm just going to note it. He's also a black gentleman. This is an impressive guy. Just because he didn't buy into what the surrender Republicans in D.C. had to say about about January 6th, about the 2020 election, and frankly, those quisling Republicans who folded in with the Democrat Socialists on two sham impeachments, because he didn't back any of that, he's some sort of... fringe Trump-backed candidate? Hardly. Hardly. In fact, taking all the Trump out of the equation, he's a much more impressive guy than Pete Meyer.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
It's been a real bloodletting for all of those who participated in the sham impeachments and who voted to authorize or... are outward sympathizers, or even one remaining member of the January 6th Star Chamber. Been a real bloodletting since 2020, and you know what? Good. Good. Because if you fell in with either of those sham impeachments, then there's one of two things. One, you don't understand how you're being manipulated by the left and the D.C. press corps, or two, you do understand it. And either way, it's disqualifying. So see you later, Pete Meyer. It wasn't that nice knowing you. We upgraded for
big time
that office and that district, although that district has become a little bit more Dem since the remap, so it's not going to be any cakewalk, but I like Gibbs's chances. You've got relatives in Arizona. Who'd they vote for?
My mom voted for Carrie Lake, and then I had other relatives that voted for Robeson because I thought Carrie Lake was a little unhinged, a little too Trumpy, a little too, I don't know, they just rubbed them the wrong way. But I'm known Carrie Lake because being in the business, especially working in Arizona, everybody knows everyone. And she's a tough cookie. I mean, she's going to get stuff
done. She's a former TV anchor.
I know. She's a former TV anchor.
Well, I know. Well, a lot of people don't know that.
Sorry,
they don't follow, like, you know, regional TV network affiliate TV people like you think they do.
I know. I'm sorry. But she is, I mean, she's sassy, but she's a female Trump. I think she's a female version of Trump. She's going to do what's best for the state of Arizona. But there was, you know, a point of contention yesterday because she said the voting's already been rigged. And that, you know, if she loses, it's because there's something nefarious going on. But they said, well, if there's a crime, you should report it. And she said, well, I'll just wait. I'm not going to tell you. So,
Bob in Buffalo Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for taking my call. In Arizona, how did Rusty Bowers do? Because he was adamant about being an anti-Trumper.
He gone.
He's gone?
He gone.
Drop kick, punt. Boop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He lost. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Have a great day.
Thanks for the call.
Looking forward to your show.
Thanks
but you know what's
call,
weird? Because Mom called yesterday and she said, well, she voted early before they went on their family reunion. And, you know, early ballot, absentee ballot. She got another ballot in the mail yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
On election day.
That's actually an interesting
topic. She said, what should I do? And I said, well, don't vote twice and keep it.
It's an interesting topic, how election turnout will change in, like, going forward in states that have adopted COVID rules as the way that they're going to administer elections. Because you saw, you know, a big spike in 2020, of course. And one wonders when you have election officials pushing out ballot applications, if you'll see some sustained increase. It'll in an off year, it'll be less than in a presidential year, but some sustained increase in the overall turnout that changes the nature of fundamentally changes the composition of the electorate, and in ways that are difficult to predict. I think that's an open question because it's too soon to really have any longitudinal data on it. But it's an interesting question because it informs how people run campaigns. Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan, how are you?
Good. So
the abortion issue is not supposed to be a issue, but someone didn't get the memo in Kansas because this got pretty walloped.
Yeah.
Do you see that as an issue coming up? Is it something that needs to be paid attention to? I think if going to sleep on this issue is not a good thing.
Well, I don't know that anybody's, thanks for the call. I don't know that anybody's advocated going to sleep on the issue. I think you need to continue to make arguments on the issue, which I've always said. I've never said go to sleep on it. I think you need to focus on things in states where you're not going to get a prohibition on most abortions. You need to focus. And this is the point of the 50 laboratories of democracy. This is the point of the Dobbs decision. You need to focus on what is sellable and reflective of the majority opinion. So, for example, in Illinois, that would be parental notification. It would be not taxpayer funding of abortions all 9 months. It would not be late-term abortions. Those are all things, even in pro-abortion Illinois, which is not as pro-abortion as you think, as many people think, I should say, that a majority, that's where a majority of the Illinois electorate is. Kansas is not as conservative a state as some people perceive it to be. I mean, they've got a Democrat governor right now, for example. But I think the challenge in Kansas and states that are purplish generally and maybe on this issue is when you have a question that's perceived as eliminating abortion, that that's your angle. And that's not where the majority is, then you have a tougher sell. There are many people that would be fine with the legislature in Kansas pushing forward measures to do exactly what I said could be done in Illinois, and even probably going further in Kansas, probably at least to a heartbeat law. But it was perceived to be a referendum on whether abortions will be allowed at all. And I think that's in part why you saw that question go down. Craig in Mount Greenwood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy, and thank you, Dan, for taking my call. Listen, this whole question about people, you know, sticking with Trump and all that stuff, and then the anti-Trumpers and those who basically, you know, have been working against them and basically all that stuff. Let me tell you something. Those of us who voted for Trump and everything before, and then people at work and all that that didn't even vote for Trump before, but they're for him now, we're stronger and more than ever before. And the thing is that January 6th, what it did is it made us a little bit like we're not outspoken, real outspoken or anything like that. If someone's taking a survey or something, we don't really say much, but we're there and we're ready to pounce. And that's why any opportunity to support Trump, we're just doing it just because all the shenanigans, all the crap that constantly go on, and we're supporting them.
I mean, yeah, thanks for the call, Craig. I think not much has changed since 2016 in this sense. Trump and a lot of Trump-backed candidates via Trump represent the same thing he represented in 2016. I know these people. They're worse than you think. And what he continues to be a master at with some candidates for state and federal offices helping is exposing posers in the Republican Party and exposing socialists for the socialists they are. And that has been unbelievably helpful and clarifying. And it continues.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy doing a stop, look, and listen on the governor's race in Illinois. And we're going to fold in the mayor's race, too, since they're, frankly, races that effectively run concurrently, even though, of course, one's in November and the other is in February with an eye towards April. Stop, look, and listen a month after the primary. How do you think it's going for the conservative reform side? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Darren Bailey, of course, who I'm supporting, and I assume, Amy, you are now in the general.
And I didn't in the primary.
Right.
But I am now.
And
it's hard to wrap ourselves around him right now, because I feel as if he's doing more damage control than he is campaigning.
It's not the best post-primary election month I've ever seen from a campaign.
No. And this is a Facebook Live that he did years ago. It was a lot skinnier back then, so you could tell it was...
5 years ago.
5 years ago. And talking, comparing abortion to the atrocities of the Holocaust.
The attempted extermination of the Jews of World War II, it doesn't even compare on a shadow of the life that has been lost and with abortion since its legalization.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. That got a lot of stern reaction. Let's start with Laura Welch. She's president of the National Organization of Women.
Oh, yeah. Gee, I wonder what she has to say.
You take that murder of 6 million people and you want to compare that to something like a person's right to make self-determination about their own body, about their own rights. It is so heinous. It is so disgusting.
And then there's State Rep Bob Morgan, Democrat, Highwood. He's from the Jewish caucus.
My great-grandparents were killed in the Holocaust. This is something intensely personal to me and my family. And to have somebody so cavalierly use the idea and the concept of genocide in context for political points, it's so unfathomable to me.
And, of course, Jelly Belly has a new ad up that features that remark.
Right, and he tweeted out yesterday, to equate the Holocaust to a woman's right to choose is not only disturbing, but it's also disqualifying.
Mm-hmm.
But one person that's defending Bailey, Amy Gerke from the Illinois Right to Life.
Planned Parenthood, as well as the Pritzker campaign, are using this to deflect what the real issue is. The fact that Illinois' abortion laws are radical and even too radical for many who identify as pro-choice.
That's exactly right. Amy Gerke's exactly right. Amy Gerke is a good surrogate for the Bailey campaign. You know, here's the thing about the comment. I mean, how many times for how many years have I said this?
Never compare anything to the Holocaust.
Pretty much. I mean, it's a sort of Godwin's law, right? Godwin's law. The longer discussion on the internet goes, the possibility of Hitler being invoked trends to one. Like 100%. So for the now shrew and for that pea hat Bob Morgan from Highwood, you know, spare me. Spare me the performative moral indignation, because you're part of a party that calls everybody with whom they disagree Hitler. So spare me. That said, and for candidates listening, here's a little tip for you. Hitler is Hitler, and that's it. The Holocaust is the Holocaust, and that's it. There's no sense in comparing one atrocity to another atrocity. This isn't fantasy atrocity. Let things stand on their own and argue the merits of a particular policy impact on their own without folding in horrors from history that are asymmetrical. It's a problem people have who don't think about things, who get sort of whipped into frenzy on a particular topic they're passionate about. Or a particular candidate they're passionate about, or a particular candidate they're passionate about opposing. They have to trend towards hyperventilation. And you, by the way, you just heard that from that now shrew and that pea hat Bob Morgan, trending towards hyperventilation.
Well, Bailey issued a response yesterday saying, quote, "The Holocaust is a human tragedy without parallel. In no way was I attempting to dismiss the atrocities of the Holocaust and its stain on history. I meant to emphasize the tragedy of millions of babies being lost."
Yeah, I understand the effort, and you're trying to, I guess, provide some sort of proportionality. Unhelpful. Undisciplined. Lacking in thought. And this, you know, can be a problem that spans the political spectrum, unfortunately. There's a lot of people that are center-right, and I'm not just talking about conservatives. I mean, I'm talking about center-right. That need to be a little bit more thoughtful and a little bit more measured in their remarks. And I'm not saying you have to pull punches in anticipation of the attacks that you know will come from the left, because they're going to come anyway. I'm saying that you have to have your audience in mind and be commonsensical and accessible rhetorically. And that doesn't mean speaking at a fifth grade level, which is one of these cliches of politics I reject. It means talking to people like you would talk to them if you were having a conversation at a restaurant, rather than talking to them like you're standing at a podium at a rally trying to whip people into action and feel like you need to come over the top with motivational / incendiary rhetoric. I guess that's why I'm not such a great rally speaker. But that's okay. It's just a lesson. It's a lesson for candidates. By the way, I was thinking about this yesterday, and Paul Vallis, with this whole Awake Illinois contretemps that he's walked himself into, is another good example of this.
Yeah, he bowed to the mob.
So he goes to this Awake Illinois event that's a panel discussion on school choice that's raising money for Cory Brooks' Project Hood in the city on the south side. And then he gets questioned by the jackals in the Chicago Press Corps about Awake Illinois, because, of course, they have a caricature of Awake Illinois as being anti-LGBT and blah, 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 blah.
Homophobic, transphobic.
Because they oppose things like the sexualization of children in primary grades, which is an offense to the Chicago and Springfield Press Corps. Of course it is. And rather than saying to that press corps, Paul Vallis I'm talking about, look, I went to a school choice event because I'm interested in the issue, because I'm a proponent of school choice. A proponent of the tax credit scholarships. I'm a proponent of innovation and education. I've spent my professional career doing it. That's why I'm there. I'm really interested in the topic, and I want to bring as many people, be a part of as many coalitions that are out there, bring as many people to the table on the issue as possible, because what Illinois lacks is the number of educational opportunities for children that from families without resources. So that's what I want to be a part of.
That would have been such a simple answer. Walk away, just say that.
Because I attend events of a particular organization doesn't mean I adopt the position of every organization or every person in the organization. It's silliness. That's not what he said. What he said, I went there, Project Hood. What they're doing, Awake Illinois, they're anti-LGBTQ. And they're trying to play that card.
Yeah, and he condemned the Naperville group for calling the bakery drag show perverted and for calling Pritzker a groomer.
Had I been aware of the hateful rhetoric expressed by a prominent member of the group, I would have not accepted the invitation. I will be more vigilant about vetting invitations in the future. A complete capitulation. Totally undisciplined. Not a people pleaser, a press pleaser. And let me tell you something. If you're coming after their chosen in public office, you want to be a press pleaser? Thank you very much, they will say, because you're ensuring that we will be able to carry our person across the finish line. Even Lori Lightfoot. Totally undisciplined, totally thoughtless, and I wouldn't describe Paul Vallis as thoughtless, generally speaking, nor would I describe Darren Bailey as thoughtless, generally speaking. Bad campaign advice, I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's the work product. That's how you're going to be judged. So you got a problem. You want to take out Jelly Belly? You want to take out Lightfoot? Triple threat? You're going to need candidates that are a little bit more disciplined than they've displayed so far in the campaign. There's time. These are not mortal wounds. But it is something that should be acknowledged. And they do need to make some course corrections if they're going to be successful. I'll tell you that. Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, more than just disciplined, willing to fight. Bailey should have said this. Well, both are tragic, but which is more tragic?
No,
that Jelly Belly is willing to give teens the right to an abortion without notification of their parents. If these men aren't willing to fight, they're going to get steamrolled, just like Bruce Rauner did
four years ago. I agree about fighting, but you know how you fight is also important. We're not playing fantasy atrocity. That is unproductive to be gentle about it. Terry, Rogers Park.
Yeah, I don't see why Bailey's comparison of abortion to the Holocaust was so offensive. I think it was a good comparison.
Why?
It's murder. It's murder. Just the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, Terry. Tom in Deer Park.
Yeah, Dan, Bailey's comments, ignorant and repulsive as they were from 6 years ago. And part of me almost wants to cut people some slack. And I'll give an example. When you referred to Alexander Vindman and his dual nationality and loyalty, that's an anti-Semitic slur. But yet when you said it,
Excuse me. Go pound sand, you hack. You liar. I never questioned Alexander Vindman's patriotism. I questioned his professionalism as a military officer. I questioned his testimony at that sham impeachment. Never said anything like that, you scumbag, Tom in Deer Park. And you can play that game with lesser intellects, you piece of garbage, Tom from Deer Park. You can join all those Chicago press corps types. You fancy yourself as a libertarian, you lying, disingenuous piece of garbage. You are no better than the lying, disingenuous pieces of garbage that smeared John Cass when he reported on George Soros. We reported on Alexander Vindman. I disagreed with him and I criticized him for his conduct, particularly as a military officer. They never questioned his patriotism, reported his dual citizenship. That was not any dog whistle I deployed. What you just did is a dog whistle, and you're a tool of the left, you phony libertarian scumbag piece of human garbage, Tom from Deer Park. That's how you push back against scumbag, disingenuous pieces of human garbage like the Chicago press corps who smeared John Cass and like people like Tom from Deer Park, never Trumper troglodytes.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission: to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We can't let this go. We can't let what was done, and frankly is still being done, by COVIDian politicians and public health officials. We can't let it go. There needs to be a reckoning for what was done, an understanding of what continues to be done, so as to push back against it continuing to be done, or what was done being done again.
And what's going to be done in 3 more weeks when Chicago public school kids go back to school. Yeah. You're going to do the quarantining again. If you're not vaccinated, you're going to be shamed. If you're around somebody, you're going to have to be kicked out of school for 5 days. But just so you know, LA Unified School District, last Friday, big announcement there. They are done testing kids. They are done with quarantining. They are done with all of that. Masks are optional, but they're not going to be, you know, part of the public health department. If you're sick, you take your kid to the doctor. It's brilliant.
It's not brilliant. It's just basic.
It's obvious. I'm saying that's a big union that has decided to stop with this nonsense.
Uh-huh. Well, that's prospective, but there's a retrospective piece of this, too, that should inform policies prospectively. We have, as I mentioned before, Mike Scott's newscast, a Senate Health Committee hearing today. Rand Paul previewed that with Brett Baer, our friend Brett Baer, yesterday. This is specifically about gain-of-function research. Why is this important? Because there's a lot of evidence, and Rand Paul believes, that we finance gain-of-function research by scientists who work for one of the enemies of our country. That's important. We potentially financed the weaponization of viruses, research to advance that cause, by scientists who work for Chinese communists, who work for a regime that seeks to displace America and the West. Subjugate, not just displace. Is that relevant? I think so.
Before we even get to whether the virus came from a lab, we have to explore, were they doing gain-of-function research? Were they taking viruses, mixing them with unknown viruses, and creating more lethal viruses, or viruses that were more infectious or transmissible? I say without question they were doing this. Anthony Fauci says they weren't. Tomorrow we will have the first gain-of-function hearing on Capitol Hill, the first exploration of this topic in 2 years. 1 million Americans died, and we have not had one single hearing. Tomorrow we have the first hearing, and I'll ask 3 scientists, very esteemed scientists, scientists with hundreds of papers, peer-reviewed papers, editors of journals. This is an elite group of scientists that will be there tomorrow. I'm going to ask them, was it gain-of-function research that was going on in Wuhan? That doesn't prove it came from a lab, but it proves that dangerous research was happening there and that it could have come from the lab. And my question is, even if we don't know for certain, let's say it's 50-50, that's still a big probability that it came from the lab. At that point, wouldn't we want to make sure we're controlling? You know, we have restrictions on exporting nuclear technology. Should we have restrictions on exporting DNA technology to communist China? I think yes.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, of course, this has been a long-running argument between Rand Paul and Tony Fauci, that sad little man. And, there's disagreement. So we need to get to the bottom of it, just like we need to get to the bottom of the origin of the virus and hold, perhaps, the Chinese communists accountable for what they did, if some of what they did was purposeful. Right. Just like we would hold, terrorists who attacked and took down the Twin Towers on 9/11 accountable for what they did, all the way up to al-Zawahiri this week. Yeah, this is important. Can't let it go. And, you know, the other thing we can't let go, or the reason we can't let it go, is because one of the things I think we found out during the height of the pandemic is that there's a lot of politicians in this country who would be perfectly comfortable being part of the Chinese Communist Politburo, at least on this issue and perhaps others, since we modeled our response in some quarters, and that was the not only the suggestion, that was the action taken, modeled our response after what China did.
So did Israel, so did so many other countries, except for the brave people of Sweden. They didn't fall for it.
That's right. They had better public health officials providing sounder advice, didn't they?
And they weren't trying to be stars. Like our public health officials, you know, it was all about the media and hits on media, on social media. I mean, Dr. Awardi, Dr. Nsike, they throw out the first pitch at baseball games. That's gross. That is not stay in your lane.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was all about, you know, elevating their character and their agenda and their, you know, their fame.
Cheryl,
they're famous now.
Cheryl Atkison, investigative journalist, friend of the show. We've had her on many times. She's got a good program, good news program called Full Measure. She her most recent edition that I think released on Friday features a conversation with Dr. Jay Bhattacharya from Stanford, who's an MD and also a PhD in economics.
And he's been on our show.
Well, many times. And it wasn't. This is something else that we can't let go. At least if you believe in science and its application and its advancement for the betterment of humanity. Starting with the Great Barrington Declaration and the genesis of it, where you had Bhattacharya, Stanford, Gupta, Oxford, Kulldorff, Harvard, come together to make a simple statement that has been signed now by tens of thousands of public health professionals, medical doctors, policymakers. A simple declaration that the approach that was being taken was not the right approach, and the approach that should be taken is something akin to what we've done in previous pandemics.
The older populations and other people with severe chronic conditions, the predisposed and the bad outcomes if they get COVID. And for the rest of the population, let's live as close to normal lives as possible. That's it. That's the strategy. The fact is that there's a thousandfold difference in the risk of severe disease. Oldest people, very high risk of death. 80% of deaths are people over 65 around the world. Whereas young people, especially children, are very low risk for severe disease. Right, very low death rates.
You had a lot of scientists sign on to that. Do you know how many?
Tens of thousands of scientists and doctors signed on. We have almost 950,000 regular people. This despite like big tech suppression of it. The idea is not even original. It's the same pandemic plan we followed for decades in respiratory pandemic after respiratory pandemic. As recently as 2009 with the H1N1 flu pandemic. It's essentially the Great Barrington Declaration, except it wasn't called that then.
Right, and as we know, we've discussed at some length on the show, but let's revisit not letting it go. The response from the public health officials in charge of our government, and that's how it was, the troika of Fauci, Collins, and Redfield for much of the pandemic, we know from emails, go smear them. That's a translation. The actual words I think Collins used was they need a published rebuke. And that's not, I don't think that's verbatim, but it's something to that effect. It was a sanitized version of go smear them. We've got these fringe scientists who need a published chastising of the Great Barrington Declaration. And Bhattacharya describes that smear.
It was essentially an organized propaganda campaign started by the NIH, at least as best I can tell with the FOIA documents I've seen so far, to marginalize me, to call me fringe, even though I've been a Stanford professor for 20 years in the medical school. I would have thought that if I were in Tony Fauci's position, and you have prominent outside scientists saying, look, the strategy we're following is deadly and leading to too many deaths for and not particularly is not saving lives, is bad for bad. I would have engaged with those scientists to try to understand what are they talking about. Instead, I've never heard from him. And I felt the brunt of the propaganda campaign where he had friendly reporters come and try to attack me. His friendly to him come and attack me.
Another aspect of this, of course, is the purse strings. You know, these research scientists are significantly dependent on federal grant funds. The tens of billions of dollars of grant funds controlled by Tony Fauci, Francis Collins, now Rochelle Walensky, and who replaced Redfield. But so this is the lifeblood, particularly in academic institutions.
I mean, I've been funded the NIH most of my life, or most of my career, last 20 years. It helps, like, convince your university, for instance, that you should get tenure. A lot of scientists looking at this say, okay, well, these are fringe ideas. I better stay silent or else my career is threatened. And that's what's happened. They use their power to silence scientists. And that is a conflict of interest.
And so the lesson, even somebody as bright as Jay Bhattacharya, you know, sometimes you get in your own bubble and you think that people are, I don't know, even-handed. They're trying to do the right thing. You don't appreciate what's actually happening until you're in the thick of it. And after a little time for reflection, although he said something akin to what you're about to hear to us on this program as well, and this is several months back, but this is a top-line takeaway that people should take heed.
Scientific discussions that I took for granted for most of my career cannot survive a situation where you have government bodies controversializing perfectly reasonable positions, suppressing debate and suppressing discussion, employing propaganda techniques like big tech or the press to attack. Personally attack the lives of scientists who disagree. Now, you cannot have science where the government essentially can control what it wants to have happen. There has to be freedom for science to actually work. And I didn't fully understand that before the pandemic, but now I see it.
No freedom, no science.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And this is, we've again talked about it a bit, but this is a part of it we can't let go. Can't let go of the school shutdowns and the impact on social, emotional, intellectual development of kids, how hurt they were. Can't let go of the inducement to destructive behaviors that have led to record high overdoses and suicide rates. Can't let that go. Can't let go how our nation's foremost enemy may have had bad intentions with respect to money that was being drop-shipped from our government to their scientists through intermediaries and the origin of the virus itself. Can't let go of all the mandates and impositions, the economic destruction. But you also can't let go of what this has done to science, and that one of the mitigations was this propaganda campaign that Bhattacharya is describing, was eliminating the scientific method, eliminating the sort of peer review and robust debate that should happen in every professional setting, but perhaps no more important a place than in the scientific community. You cannot let what they did to discussions among people that were similarly credentialed, similarly knowledgeable about the topic, how the combination of the government and the government press corps in D.C. attempted to silence or otherwise assassinate the characters of people like J. Jay Bhattacharya. Can't let that go. Bill in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Hey, listen, you know, we're pretty well obvious of what's happening with the Bidens being compromised by China. Let's use that same focus with Anthony Fauci. I mean, this man's working hand-in-hand, shaking hands with Wuhan. There's a strong possibility, even though he's opened up the books, per se, for things to be looked at, but there's a nefarious counterpart somewhere that, you know, this man's shaking hands with China and it's not financially influenced. Someone's got to look a little closer at that.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Well, there has been some look at the royalties to NIH personnel, though you don't get the level of detail that you would otherwise desire, but the Open the Books organization has been on that. We've talked a bit about that. They've gotten some detail, but not near the detail that we should have from, well, government-paid employees, you know, state taxpayer-paid employees. They're government employees, and he's the highest-paid government employee. So, yeah, we should have full disclosure on him. You're absolutely right. And, you know, maybe we get that next year if you've got Republican control of both chambers. Certainly on the Senate side, Rand Paul is not letting go of this, and that's good news. And I don't think Ron Johnson will either. So another reason to reelect Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. David in Lansing.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Remember about 1, 2, or 3 decades ago when all the 20-something and 30-something young Democrats, I call them the pot smokercrats, would go out and demonstrate against the corporations, man? Well, what is Joe Biden doing? About a week ago, Biden came out and said, we need a 3-pronged approach to fight COVID. We need boosters, we need masks, and we need Paxlovid from Pfizer. Now, 2 out of 3 of those is Pfizer. Joe Biden is a corporatist whore working for Moderna, Pfizer, BioNTech, and Johnson & Johnson. He did not mention zinc, an effective treatment against many viruses. There are tens of studies, if not hundreds, that show zinc is effective against the common cold. It is widely known that zinc fights the virus, yet the corporatist whore-in-chief did not mention a treatment like that. Why not? Because he's working for the corporations, man, you pot smokercrats. Wake up.
Thanks for the call, David. Mike Plano.
Hey, I'm kind of going where that last guy was going a little bit because, looking back at how the government's response to COVID was when Trump and Pence were in office, I've said this before to people. One of the best things Trump did in office was form a public-private partnership because it did help get the supply chains going. It helped get things back on shelves, et cetera. But it was also one of the worst things he's done because it just opened the door to so much corruption, so much crony capitalism, state capitalism, corporate welfare. You saw these endless propaganda commercials from these corporations, Pfizer and countless others. And it just me witnessing that during that time was just so disturbing, especially since it was happening under a Trump presidency.
Yeah.
And he even implemented an Andrew Yang-type monetary policy where he's giving out free money away.
Not to mention invoking the National Defense Production Act, which is dubious.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the problem. That's the problem when you shut down your economy, for God's sakes. Yeah.
I understand.
Wait. But to your point. I mean, let's make sure we connect the dots here. You shut down your economy, then you insinuate yourself deeper into the business world to reopen the economy and reconstruct supply chains and so on and so forth. And wherever the government is able to insinuate itself, it is not inclined to leave.
And let's not forget about changing the way we do elections. I mean, COVID changed all of that with mail-in ballots and all.
Thanks, Mike.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. Don't miss Cigar Night with Dennis Prager, Dan Proft, and Sean Thompson on Thursday, August 18th. Get your tickets today at 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, when veteran prosecutor Jim Murphy resigned last week. He wrote in his resignation statement, how many mass shootings do there have to be before something is done? This administration, meaning Kim Fox, is more concerned with political narratives and agendas than with victims and prosecuting violent crime. That is why I can't stay any longer. It was that's the money line from his statement, as far as I'm concerned. More concerned with political narratives and agendas than with victims and prosecuting violent crime. That's why I can't stay any longer, he said of Kim Fox. Kim Fox responded yesterday to his resignation and others with this generic offering.
Kim Fox's office says, quoting now, "We recognize the rigors of this difficult work and the toll that it bears, yet over 1,100 employees show up every day to work on the front lines and behind the scenes in a testament of the resiliency and spirit of this office."
Not exactly responsive to the critique leveled by Jim Murphy.
And we've had so many more people since Jim Murphy's resignation. You had the a supervisor at the Bridgeview Courthouse. He resigned saying, quote, "Our victims and their families desperately need to have the same courage to stand up and fight for them in the courtroom." That's from Ted Lagerwal. And a third chair for felony review resigned yesterday, plus two other assistant state's attorney's office. So the total now is 237 who have left. And last year at the same time, 135 had left. So it's almost doubled the amount of people who've walked out the door.
And we talked before about some people that we know in the criminal justice system on the defense side. So interacting with prosecutors on a routine basis, what they're saying about the quality of people replacing those who are leaving, not complimentary, as you might imagine. And one wonders about some of the new hires, on what basis are they being hired when you're talking about identitarian political hacks like Kim Fox. So that's why, that's one thing. Something else, though, about Murphy and the response. So two things. One, Kim Fox felt compelled to issue a statement after, I'm sure, days of discussing whether or not they should acknowledge Jim Murphy left and if they should acknowledge him specifically and if they should respond on point to anything he had to say.
But if anybody watches local news, Murphy is the face of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. He's in court every day. He's the one that's talking to reporters about specific cases.
And secondly, what does Jim Murphy know that they don't want people to know? In other words, they didn't go back at Jim Murphy. Why? Because he's been there for almost three decades, and he's been there so since Kim Fox, the last 5 years Kim Fox has been in office. And one wonders what Jim Murphy, the stories Jim Murphy could tell if he was provoked to tell them.
Well, he spoke to the Tribune yesterday and pretty much doubled down about, you know, why he left. And he said the portion of the letter speaks for itself. I just didn't have the confidence in the administration's leadership, that being the executive level of the administration. He said, it's not about me. Everybody's head is down in that office, and I just wanted to help people keep their heads up and let them know what they do matters.
Yeah, so that's a repeat of his resignation letter. What I'm saying is, why didn't Kim Fox poke the bear?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
One wonders if Jim Murphy might have more to say if he was prompted to be specific. We'll see. We'll see.
We'll try to get him on the show, too.
Related story, response in part to the Soros op-ed in the Wall Street Journal we've been talking about for the last couple of days. Good piece by Rafael Manguel, friend of the show over at City Journal. Just a point of order on this, since over the next 6 to 9 months, you're going to hear nothing but identitarian political pap from those in office trying to salvage their careers as they preside over the destruction of a great city and great state. That would be Chicago and Illinois I'm talking about specifically. One of the things Soros said in his vanilla data-free op-ed in the Journal. Black people in the U.S. are 5 times as likely to be sent to jail as white people. That's a statement you would hear from Kim Fox, from Lori Lightfoot, from J.B. Pritzker. He says it without explanation, Manguel writes. Such a contention is meant to persuade the reader these incarcerations are mostly, if not overwhelmingly, illegitimate. What else could it be? Well, how about disparate rates of criminal offending? Bureau of Justice Statistics study of homicides between 1980 and 2008, almost 4 decades, found that blacks commit homicide offenses at a rate almost 8 times higher than the rate for whites. So maybe that has something to do with the incarceration rate of 5 times more likely to be sent to prison than whites, because they're 8 times more likely to commit murder than whites. I mean, we're just talking about the rates of incidents. He goes on, Manguel does, when relevant factors are taken into account, the disparity Soros points to as obvious evidence of injustice shrinks substantially. 2014 report on incarceration from the National Academy of Sciences, quote, racial bias and discrimination are not the primary causes of disparities in sentencing decisions or rates of imprisonment. Overall, when statistical controls are used to take account of offense characteristics, prior criminal records, and personal characteristics, black defendants are on average sentenced somewhat, but not substantially more severely than whites. The institutional racism, systemic injustice that Kim Fox and Lori Lightfoot and J.B. Pritzker pretend they're fighting is just that, pretend. Oh, by the way, their pretending comes at the expense of your safety. And in 2020, on the other side of the ledger, the victims, which I appreciate the people who resigned from Fox's office remembering, oh, yes, it's putting people away, and it's also getting justice for victims and trying to prevent more people from being victimized by the same people. Yeah, basic stuff. In 2020, a year in which homicides rose nearly 30% across the United States, lockdown year, the share of white homicide victims actually declined by 2.5 points relative to 2019, while the share of black and Hispanic victims increased by 2.2 percentage points. The black homicide victimization rate, not talked about enough, was 10 times that of the white homicide victimization rate in 2020. In my home city of New York, Manguel writes, at least 95% of shooting victims every year going back to at least 2008 are either black or Hispanic. Same thing in Chicago, with over 80% of the victims being black. And why don't we ever hear from these dogged leaders from the black community who are primarily concerned with protecting minority communities? Well, they'll protect them from a cross word, but they won't actually protect their physical being. Well, why don't we ever hear from them about the victimization rate disparity? Gee, I wonder. I wonder why that is.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. And then you hit this yesterday from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. They let that kid go. They let the 17-year-old Hadi Abdallah, who was pulled over by Oaklawn police, resisted arrest. They found a weapon, 3 rounds, and then there was video of Oaklawn officers punching him. And he's out.
There was video of Oaklawn officers corralling him as he resisted arrest and attempted to get to his satchel, which had a gun in it. And they used the tactics that they were trained to use to disable somebody resisting arrest, like punching in the leg, so as to get his hands behind his back and gain control of him since he was resisting. That's what they did.
And not only is he out, he was charged with unlawful use of a weapon and resisting arrest. Now the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, they haven't decided if they'll follow through on these charges, and they let him out yesterday.
It was amazing. Thank y'all for all the support.
And, of course, people from Rainbow Push were there saying this, you know, the families, the right, this was a racially motivated attack. They're going to file, they filed a civil lawsuit against the officers in the department.
Those officers should be fired. They should be terminated.
That's right.
And they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
They should be fired and terminated. Can you explain the difference between those two terms? They should be none of the above.
Exactly.
And the whole racial complaint is, I mean, so predictable, and it flies in the facts, in the face of the evidence.
Well, what is this teaching that kid?
The stop, the traffic stop, driver gets out, he complies, officers search him, he complies, no issue. Passenger, this kid gets out, they go to pat him down, he takes off. They catch up to him. He resists arrest. This has nothing to do with race and everything to do with behavior. And that's the case about 99% of the time, including with the highest profile cases that get national attention that we discuss.
I always start with resisting arrest. George Floyd, I mean, we can go through the gambit of all this.
Bob, Southside.
Hi, Dan and Amy. Dan, to answer your question as to what Jim Murphy knows, and in full disclosure, I used to work with Jim Murphy. Jim Murphy knows the truth, and he probably could talk a lot about a lot of cases where victims have been absolutely not represented to the extent that they should be. But perhaps his greatest final contribution is a wake-up call to all of us voters here in Cook County. We had a chance to do something about this a couple of years ago, and enough people didn't vote Kim Fox out. Hopefully, that opportunity, when it comes up again, if it does, you know, people will remember the contributions and what Jim Murphy said in his resignation letter.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Bob. I hope Jim Murphy's resignation letter is not the last we hear from Jim Murphy. If he's got more to say, he should say it, because I just, look, we've had cops shot and killed, and it hasn't been enough of a wake-up call. You have 800 murders and 4,000 people shot, and it hasn't been enough of a wake-up call. You have general lawlessness and people living in terror, and it hasn't been enough of a wake-up call. People need to keep talking.
Remember in April 2021, Murphy was put on leave after Fox's office thought that his wording in the death of Adam Toledo was misleading? Remember that? But an internal investigation found that he hadn't been purposefully loose with the facts.
Yeah.
Because remember, he said police were shooting because he was resisting arrest, and that was misleading.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's what happened. Because when you see the video, Kim Fox.
If he wasn't resisting arrest, then why were they chasing him?
Hello?
There wouldn't be a chase if there was no resistance of arrest.
Remember that he was suspended for a while? That's ridiculous.
Dino in Gilbert, Illinois. Well, of course,
hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. I appreciate what you're doing. I was telling the screener that in spite of all the great news you're talking about, I wanted to encourage any retired and active police officers out there in Northwest Illinois. I'm part of the Fellowship of Christian Peace Officers, the FCPO. It's a national organization since 1970. We are hosting a law enforcement appreciation breakfast this Saturday at 9 a.m. at the Holiday Inn in Carroll Stream. And I got to tell you, this has been a godsend in my career to help me and my family navigate all the pitfalls of what we're all talking about right now. And I'm sure it's not going to get any better, but there is hope and encouragement. We don't proselytize. We do talk about God's word and let that be the standard. And, you know, it's a great organization. I just want to share that with the audience and give hope in God's word through the Fellowship of Christian Peace Officers, fcpo.org.
And the breakfast is this Saturday in Carroll Stream at?
Yeah.
Where?
Saturday, Tim. At the Carroll Stream Holiday Inn.
Oh, it comes from Holiday 9 a.m. Right, okay.
Yes, sir. From 9 a.m. to 11, it's a free breakfast. We're going to have a great guest speaker. He's going to be speaking on the culture of honor. His name is Bob Witt. And, you know, the Chicago chapter is going to come out. We're going to have a lot of, you know, fellowship and encouragement. And from that point on, we just encourage all the participants more of an awareness that there is a place for active and retired officers and even the community, your family, to support law enforcement during these really interesting, desperate times in police work.
All right. Thanks for the call, Dino. Appreciate it. Enjoy the breakfast. John in Naperville, that is.
How could these hypocrites scream and moan for gun control, but yet this guy gets with an illegal gun, shouldn't have had it, and they let him walk?
Yep.
The hypocrisy is unbelievable.
Yeah. We got, you know, Kim Fox focused on violent crime, focused on getting guns off the streets. Jeez. And then you got this case in Oak Lawn. You got the guy on Michigan in Harrison this weekend who didn't get charged for having a 40 caliber handgun with an extended clip.
And loads of ammo and
who
drugs.
He
murdered somebody.
Well, he was acquitted, so he was
at
charged.
At one point in time, he was
charged
with
murdering
murder.
Two people, but he was acquitted, so he was acquitted. But regardless, you know, this is somebody, obviously, on police radar. This is somebody who has a history of being up to no good. And you charge him on the drugs, but you don't charge him on the gun. Right. But they're really interested, really focused on guns off the street and violent criminals. Right. This is why we have multiple time felons that are on electronic monitoring so they can commit more violent felonies before they have their court date on the previous violent felony allegations, charges. It's just the turnstile at 26th and Cal under this prosecutor, which is exactly what Jim Murphy was speaking to. And again, hopefully he'll provide more and more detail as we inch closer to Election Day to inform people's votes come November and February.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and let's get right to it because we've got a lot of election results to pour over, the implications of said results, and a little bit of a stop, look, and listen at where we stand 100 days from Election Day, roughly. Steve Cortez joins us, former Trump advisor, former colleague of ours on these airwaves, now writes at stevecortez.substack.com. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Good morning. Appreciate being here.
So your former boss had a pretty good night again last night in Republican primaries in Michigan and Arizona, maybe less so Missouri.
Right. Well, in Missouri, I think he'll claim credit as he's wont to do, right? Look, competitive primaries everywhere, which I think is good for the movement, good for our country. And yes, particularly in Michigan and Arizona, I'm thrilled at the results. I think Blake Masters, for example, is going to be part of a new crop of outsider patriotic populists who are really going to change the Senate. If both he and J.D. Vance can win the general election, and I think they both will, not that they have easy races, but I think they will, I think they're going to change the complexion of that body very much, which is badly needed because, you know, for those of us who are in the America First wing of the Republican Party, even though we have 50 Republican senators, we're often incredibly disappointed at how little power they are willing to exercise and how often they really are just co-opted by the uniparty establishment of Washington, D.C. But you get folks like those two that I just named, and I think there are others out there that can and I think will win and go to the U.S. Senate with guts, people like Adam Laxalt in Nevada, and you can really change that body. You don't need – we'd love to have, of course, 51 populist America First senators. That's not going to happen, but the way the Senate works, you need 5 or 10, and there's already a few existing incumbents who are in there, people like Josh Hawley. So if we have 5 or 10 really committed folks, we can really change that body significantly. And then the race that I personally am most excited about, not too far away from Chicago, is Michigan 3, is John Gibbs. It is incredibly hard to beat an incumbent in Peter Meyer, an incumbent who has almost 100% name ID because of the stores up there, the Meyer stores, which are ubiquitous in Michigan, as well as a personal fortune. And John Gibbs pulled it off. And I think it's just an incredible triumph for the movement, certainly for him personally. And to me, that was, it was incredibly close. But to me, that was, of all the results last night, the most thrilling. It's the one that kept me up very late at night to make sure that John did indeed pull it off.
Yeah, you know, we mentioned that earlier in the program, and Gibbs is a really interesting candidate. And he's, I mean, frankly, I know Meyer comes from the big grocery store family,
there, yeah.
But I mean, John Gibbs is eminently more impressive than Pete Meyer is. And so you've got a Stanford, you know, computer science guy from Stanford with an Harvard MPA who worked at Apple, who did missionary work, who observes the Latin Mass. He's such an interesting person and sort of, you know, intellectual heavyweight. And it's just nice. It's nice to have an intellectual heavyweight. It would be nice to have more of those in the Republican caucus, but he certainly fits that bill.
Yeah, you know, and you mentioned, and look, I don't buy too much into credentialism, and I think, you know, we pay too much attention to that in American society, but when it comes to credentials, he can match his against absolutely anybody in terms of degrees and work experience and life experience. But, you know, I think he also then crushes the opposition when it comes to substance and principles. And for example, you know, you mentioned that he was a missionary. What part of his life, and he's so modest about it, I have to sort of brag for him. He was on the fast track in Silicon Valley, and having graduated from Stanford. And by the way, he also happens to be black, which makes him, you know, again, his biography just gets sort of more and more interesting. So he graduates from Stanford in computer science. He's on the fast track, working at the highest levels of Silicon Valley, knows tech from the inside, which I think could be very valuable on Capitol Hill. But he certainly never bought into the worldview of big tech, even though he was an insider because of his technical skills. And he gave that up. And when it became a missionary for the gospel, a missionary for a Christian missionary in Japan, to live a very simple and, you know, in some ways impoverished life, to learn a very difficult language, lived there for 7 years total. But I think that speaks to his character and to what kind of a man he is. So he's just an incredibly impressive young guy. He's done a heck of a lot for a young life. He'll have a tough general election race. That's not an easy district, even though it is a Republican district. It was redrawn to be slightly more Democratic. So, you know, by no means is it going to be a layup. It wouldn't have been a layup for Peter Meyer if he had somehow prevailed. But, and you know, and now is the time for Gibbs to win over those Meyer voters. So we don't want to be triumphant or spiking the football. But I will say, and he shouldn't say this, but I will say this, that Peter Meyer is exactly the kind of Republican, you know, that needed to be replaced. He was smug. He was condescending. He was more interested in pleasing MSNBC than he was in working for West Michigan. And it wasn't just the impeachment vote. That's what most people describe him about, that he voted for impeachment of Donald Trump. But there were a lot of other issues. He voted in favor of forcing girls to accept boys in transgender sports. He voted for the war in Ukraine. He voted for that recent gun control fiasco. I mean, this guy was just a very dependable Pelosi controlled opposition Republican. And those people need to lose. And for the most part, they are losing, thankfully. But on the positive side, too, you know, forget about Peter Meyer now for a moment. And again, Gibbs wants his voters, needs to earn their support. But looking at John Gibbs, I think he is really just one of the rising stars of the right now in America. I would say a lot of the same, by the way, about Blake Masters, you know, and in some ways, similar biography. Also went to Stanford, also worked at the highest levels of big tech. And Blake Masters, I think, is a guy of incredible principle. What I give him so much credit for, Dan and Amy, is that he ran an unusual campaign in some ways. He talked a ton about an issue that matters so much to me, about empowering American families to, again, thrive on a single income. And that's not necessarily an obvious question. That's not what the BT consultants would tell you to run on, right? And he ran on it boldly from the beginning. And it's such a crucial issue to him. And by the way, that doesn't mean that we're saying women can't work or that women have to stay home. What we're saying is American society used to be structured in a way where a family, a middle-class family, could thrive on a single income. That is not the case anymore. Why has it changed? How can we change it back? Is it worth changing back? What are the policies that will do it so that people have options, not telling anyone what to do with their life, but we want to empower them to be able to make that choice? And that's just one example of how he, in a lot of ways, like John Gibbs, is a very different kind of politician. He's more sort of philosophical. They both happen to be very devout Catholics. I think that's probably part of the explanation. But, you know, regardless of faith, when it comes to politics, they both take a pretty similar approach. And if they can both win, you know, I think they're going to be really effective people, really effective leaders on Capitol Hill.
So Blake Masters, he's going to be going up against incumbent Mark Kelly, and he needs some deep pockets to help his campaign because Mark Kelly has a lot of money.
Well, he's got him there. His name, Peter Thiel.
Is Peter Thiel going to pony up?
We'll see. You know, I don't know. Obviously, he did in the primary, you know, in a big way. Whether or not he will in general, we'll see. If there's one thing that we can take away from last night that is, I think, disconcerting, I think there was a lot of good news. Not all good news. I was very disappointed in the Kansas, pro-life issue, and certainly we can talk about that if you like. But if there's one thing we learned last night, I think, or, you know, relearned that is bad news, I think, as an American, is that, boy, money talks in politics. I mean, it really does. You know, for example, in that Arizona race, Kerry Lake, it looks like, is going to just squeak out a win. But Robeson, who I think was a totally unimpressive candidate, had little to offer except her husband's fortune, but $20 million of spending in the primary, and she made it really, really close. So the reality is money matters, right? Name ID matters incredibly. If it weren't for the fact that Kerry Lake is a, you know, three-decade-long staple of the news scene there, the TV news scene as a primetime anchor in the Phoenix area, if she didn't have that kind of name ID, I don't think she could have won, given the money that she was coming up against. So it's unfortunate, but it's just the reality in politics. Money really, really matters. And last night, I think, exemplified that.
Well, let's quickly go back to Michigan, because Tudor Dixon, I mean, that primary race was just all over the place when you had the two top contenders. What, they had signature irregularities on their petition, so they were knocked out. Does she just stand a chance against Whitmer?
You know, I think so. If she runs a really effective race, and I think she will. Look, I think she, a lot like Kerry Lake, by the way, brings a significant broadcasting experience. Not as much as Lake, but she's been in broadcasting. She's an incredibly impressive personal story. And I think there are going to be two really great female versus female contests. That one in Arizona you mentioned, and then this one against Gretchen Whitmer. I think with Gretchen Whitmer, as long as Tudor does a very good job of framing the race in some ways as a referendum on Whitmer did during the 2020 lockdowns, because a lot of that, the polling certainly shows us, a lot of Michiganders are still understandably irate at what went on there, because she was maybe the worst governor in America. I know your Governor Pritzker was pretty terrible too, but Whitmer might have been the worst governor in America, both in terms of policies and in terms of the condescension surrounding those policies.
Listen to this guy. Wait, hold on. Listen to this guy. Your Governor Pritzker.
Wow, how quickly you've moved on.
It's Mr. Tennessee boy. doesn't remember being in Chicago for the last, most of your life.
For 50 years. Yeah.
Your governor. He's our governor now. Oh, okay. All right.
I hope not your governor for very much longer.
No, right.
He's going to do his best to change that.
Mm-hmm.
But regarding the Michigan race, no, listen, it'll be interesting. One thing that Whitmer always, ran on both in terms of her campaign, and one thing she just messages on constantly is, you know, sort of, I'm a strong woman. I mean, she's constantly playing that card. That's going to be hard to play against Tudor Dixon, right? Against this successful businesswoman, this mother of four. She's a woman too, right? Obviously. But I think she's in so many ways, a woman who's going to be more likable, who is more persuasive. And so that sets up for a really interesting race. And look, it's a tough one for sure. But, you know, I'm actually looking at polling right now, because I was looking at this for the Gibbs campaign, and this is State of Michigan. This is Civics polling. So to show you, and this is Biden approval. It's not Gretchen Whitmer, but still, she's obviously an ally of Joe Biden. And when Joe Biden took office in the state of Michigan, he was +3 favorable, unfavorable. He was 47 favorable, 44 unfavorable in the state of Michigan. He is now -23. He's only 33% approved in Michigan, 56% disapprove. So net -26% in Michigan. Now, you still have to make sure that Whitmer wears Biden, and that's not an easy task necessarily, but I think it can be done.
Yeah, well, and let's talk a little bit about that too, because historically what you find is that, I mean, there are anomalies and the local dynamics matter, but it is very, very, very difficult for statewide candidates to run more than 5 points ahead of the president, if that president is of their party. You when you look at Biden approval ratings, you know, add 5 to your Senate and gubernatorial races, and it gives you, you know, generally speaking, the best that those statewide Democrats can do. There'll be some exceptions, right, depending on the state. And maybe you can move, you know, closer to double figures in states that have a more friendly electorate. You know, think of the states that are blue. But it's a real challenge. That, I mean, when people say it's a drag, there's a drag. I mean, the research is pretty compelling on this count. And so this is why states like New York and Illinois are in play at the statewide level in a way they wouldn't be if Joe Biden wasn't where he is, as you're describing, and Michigan for that matter.
Right. No, exactly. And I think that's, you know, incredibly important. You know, even in the state of Illinois, by the way, that same polling, just to update it, because Civics does update its polling quite a bit. Right now in Illinois, Biden approval is only 38%, and his disapprove is at 50. So he is right now, as you know, we speak, at minus 12, and he began in this same poll, in Civics polling, he began office at plus 16. So a net 28% move against him in a year and a half.
Yeah.
And you know, Dan and Amy, that kind of a move in a year and a half is unprecedented. I mean, this is a political implosion that we have literally never seen in American history. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah, he is.
No one has descended that fast.
Right. He is dropping at 32 feet per second square. There's no question. But so now the other piece of this, and you've watched it, you've been a part of it, you've been on the campaign trail with a bunch of these candidates, from J.D. Vance to Darren Bailey to John Gibbs. Of course, you know what the other side has done and what they're saying, and you have some folks that are on the center right sort of folding in with that. The Democrats' chance is that from governor's races to congressional and Senate races, they got involved to help pick the weakest Republican candidate, and some of those weakest Republican candidates, in their view, in the press corps' view, in the Wall Street Journal editorial page's view, some of those weakest Republican candidates won, and that's their path. And Republicans, if they kick this away, they're going to have themselves to blame for nominating the wrong people.
Sure. That is certainly the conventional thinking right now of the establishment. That is what the corporatists on both sides of the aisle want us to believe, and they invested some money in that. You know, funny personal note, it's almost like they were following me around to the races I was involved in.
yeah, right.
Reality, but it was just a coincidence, and it was interesting to me. You know, I guess I'd say a couple things. The first is sort of, you know, careful what you wish for, because some of these candidates are incredibly impressive, and I think that the establishment used them as sort of crazy right-wing characters. They are definitely conservatives, absolutely, and they are right-wing. You know, unapologetically so, but they're also people of incredible substance. You know, again, as I was talking about both Masters and Gibbs, for example, and I certainly think that of Darren Bailey in Illinois. So, you know, number one, sort of careful what you wish for. But number two, I think what the establishment doesn't realize, even on the, you know, on the right or the center right, you know, the establishment, yeah, folks like the Wall Street Journal and a lot of Fox News, for example, what they don't realize, I think, is what time it is in America. And what I mean by that is that we have some existential crises in this country right now that are brewing, that, you know, were not the case. This is not the 1980s where we're arguing over sort of marginal tax rates, but we're in general agreement on first things, on sort of, you know, foundational principles. That's not the case in America today. You know, we're facing a left wing which literally doesn't acknowledge that there are two sexes. We're facing a corporate elite who have been completely co-opted by the Chinese Communist Party, the existential enemy of the United States. So it's a very different time. It's a far more polarized time. And I also think then you throw on top of that inflation, which, again, I think a lot of the elites, a lot of power brokers just don't understand. They don't understand how pernicious inflation is to regular folks, because working class people are just flailing economically right now. And the anxiety out there, and the, certainly the polling shows this, this isn't just my opinion. University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey just hit a new all-time low. That's a survey that goes back to the 1950s, so it's an enormous amount of data. Americans have never been more pessimistic than they are right now. That tells me that there is a very good chance that some of these candidates who, you know, maybe, you know, by prior standards would have been considered tough sells for their states or for their districts, that they absolutely can win. You know, and again, I guess I would just say meddling in the other side's election can often backfire.
Yes,
and,
it can.
My guess is it will this time.
He is Steve Cortez, former Trump advisor, former colleague of ours on these airwaves, and he writes at stevecortez.substack.com. Steve, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you both, Dan and Amy. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Back in the heady days of 2021, when inflation was transitory, the big guy had this to say about the policies he wanted to pursue and has pursued and is pursuing. Fast forward 13 months. This is what he said 13 months ago.
And by the way, talk of inflation, the overwhelming consensus is going to pop up a little bit and then go back down. No one's talking about this great, great deal. So, again, if it turns out that what I've done so far, what we've done so far, is a mistake, it's going to show. It's going to show the economy's not going to grow like it wasn't before. People aren't going to have jobs with increased pay like it was before. People are going to be out of work like it was before with no options. Unemployment's going to continue to climb instead of continue to go down. If that happens, then my policies didn't make a lot of sense.
I guess the question then 13 months later is, does policies not make a lot of sense? Steve Moore, economist, author of Trumponomics and GovZilla, joins us now. Steve?
Good morning.
How do we know? Hello. Did 13 months after he said, if things don't improve, then my policies didn't make a lot of sense. So what's the answer?
Well, I mean, look, everything that this president has done since he's entered office, which is 18 months ago, has been catastrophically wrong, right? We had an economy that was booming. We were coming out of COVID. This is one of my big frustrations, you know, with this whole discussion of are we or are we not in a recession? I mean, my God, the economy should be booming right now. If Trump were still president with Trump's policies, we wouldn't be talking about recession. We wouldn't be talking about 9-10% inflation. We wouldn't be talking about, $3 to $4 trillion of additional debt spending. So, look, I think that this bill is atrocious. I think it is dastardly. I think it's going to do incredible damage to an economy. Look, we have on tape Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Barack Obama, Joe Manchin, all saying that you don't raise taxes during a recession. And now they want a $500 billion tax increase. And who's going to pay it? New study just came out from the Joint Tax Committee. Half of those taxes on the businesses are going to be American manufacturers. What are they going to do? They're going to just outsource the job somewhere else. This bill makes absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm. And on the matter of loopholes, the Wall Street Journal editorial board opined about the impact of the signature 15% minimum corporate tax on this. I mean, again, this is something we've talked about over the last several days, too, right? And what you're talking about with how heavily it would fall on manufacturers. But also, and even though the numbers are relatively small, it's still a violation of what they said previously as well, which is no tax increases on household incomes over $400,000.
Right. I mean, look, the whole thing is a lie. I mean, it's laughably, and it's so transparently a lie. I mean, Joe Manchin has been on the Senate floor. I talked to a couple of senators. Don't worry, just raise taxes. What is he talking about? They've got the 15% minimum tax that's going to hit manufacturers. It's $500 billion of new revenues. And worse is that they're taking. I want people to understand this. What this bill actually does is it takes. I'm going to really simplify this. It takes about $300 billion from our pharmaceutical industry, right? It takes that money. And by the way, the pharmaceutical industry, the same one that gave us Operation Warp Speed, the vaccine for the virus that's provided incredible life-saving treatments for everything from heart disease to cancer. And, you know, we've got all these new drugs that hopefully are coming on with respect to everything from Parkinson's to Alzheimer's, to ALS and so on. And so we're going to take $300 billion from that industry, and we're going to give that money, Dan and Amy, to the green energy, what I call the climate change industrial complex, because that's what it is. It's just a massive complex that sucks the taxpayers dry. Now, what have we gotten in return for the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that we've already provided the wind and solar and battery industries. Well, do you know what percentage today of our energy comes from wind and solar power? 6 or 7%. It's trivial. We've spent all of this money and gotten nothing in return for it. In fact, it's been a negative investment. So my point is, this is the biggest misallocation of national resources maybe in American history. We should get rid of all these damn subsidies, not keep loading them on and on and on and on.
Well, how much money is going to go towards green new energy out of this Inflation Reduction Act?
Oh, huge. I mean, that's the point, $300 billion. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because they're basically paying people to buy Teslas now. I mean, that's what this bill does. You get, I think, I forget the number, $7,500 tax credit for buying a Tesla. Then if you sell your Tesla, you get another, I think, $4,500. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I don't recall people, you know, the government buying cars for people when they were, you know, gas fueled. And then you've got, oh, by the way, do you know which states dominate the purchasing of electric vehicles?
It's got to be California.
Oh, yeah. Ding, ding, ding. You got it right. You got it
well,
right.
Maybe. I was there last week, and you should have seen the line. But there were lines to use the EV. And then we were stuck on I-15 between California, between L.A. and Vegas. And cars ran out of juice. I mean, cars ran out of gas, too, because there's no exit ramps. But, I mean.
Yeah. And the reason, by the way. Yeah, and the reason people aren't buying them so much in Chicago is because when it's really cold, like in the winter, the batteries, you know, have about half as much juice as they do, you know, in the warmth of California. So this is – and this number two state is New York. So it's a typical Washington subsidy for New York and California, which accounts for, you know, throwing New Jersey, that's half of the electric vehicles. Most heavily Democratic states. My point is – Why do we want to win the race for the cure? Do everyone know someone with Alzheimer's or Parkinson's?
Steve, you're cutting out on us.
Why?
Yeah, okay, you're back. Go ahead about development of life-saving drugs and so forth.
Yeah, look, I mean, we're taking the profits out of making drugs, right? That's what they're doing. They're saying, oh, we're going to take half of your profits away. Now, again, you don't have to be an economic genius to know this. If you take away half of the profits from the drug industry, do you think they're going to develop more or fewer drugs?
Yeah, right. Here's the thing about this. This whole we're going to negotiate prescription drug prices and that's going to reduce your prices. It may or may, as you're arguing, lead to a disincentive
Less
for
damage.
Innovation.
Yeah.
We're going to do more IRS audits. We're going to, you know, ramp up IRS auditing so that everybody's paying their fair share. Well, you know, that may catch some scofflaws or it may just result in harassing audits of middle income Americans. And
of course it will.
Right. And it just goes to this thing because, you know, the Wall Street Journal earlier in the week commemorated the 20th anniversary of Sarbanes-Oxley, which was supposed to fix accounting fraud.
Right.
But what did it really do? The environmental impact statements, that's going to help the environment. But what do they really do? They're used to block transportation projects and other advancements for our quality of life. It's always sort of how they're sold where government is going to be this beneficent operator. And then we 20 years later, we measure the impacts of these programs or laws that we can't unwind. And they're almost uniformly terrible. And so we have this. I mean, I'm just using some reminders for people about what the promise was versus what the deliverable was when we're considering what these promises are that are being made today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's why I brought up the green energy. For the last 35 years, Dan and Amy, they've been saying, just give us five more years of subsidy.
Right.
Just five more years and we'll be self-sufficient. And here we are in year 40 and they're still not even near self-sufficient. But I want to make another point. You brought up the 80,000 new IRS agents. I don't know if either of you saw the headline from a couple of days ago that the Army is over 2 years, 25,000 short of the troops that they need because people aren't signing up. So you have 25,000 shortage of our soldiers that we need for our national security, and the border security is also short about 10,000. So wouldn't it make more sense if we're going to spend this money rather than hiring more IRS agents, maybe it's a higher priority to protect our border and to protect our national security than to hire more IRS agents. And has anyone forgotten, have you forgotten, Dan or Amy, who Lois Lerner was? She, for those people who have forgotten, she was the Obama head of one of the major enforcement agencies at the IRS. And what did she do? She basically targeted...
But for their political and religious beliefs.
Republican, her, yeah. Yeah, they are going to weaponize the IRS. Be, oh, no, we won't do that. You already did. You already did. And by the way, Lois Lerner never went to jail. She should have gone to jail.
Never charged with anything.
Well, she should have been. Shame on the Republicans when they took over Congress not to investigate that. But my point is, you know, having gone through an IRS audit recently where they claimed we owed $50,000. Remember when I was up for the Federal Reserve Board?
Yeah.
The first hit piece on me was Steve Moore can't be on the Federal Reserve Board. He has a tax lien on he hasn't paid $50,000 of taxes. They put that on the front page of the Washington Post and New York Times. I don't know if I ever told you this, but about 3 months after I had to withdraw, I get a letter from the IRS says, whoopsie daisy, you're right. We owe you money. You don't owe us money. I'm like, where do I get my reputation?
Yeah, right.
Oh,
right.
I'm so sorry that happened to you. It's not surprising.
Question.
By the way, hold on. Let me tell you the rest of the story.
Yeah.
My attorney, because I had to hire an attorney and an accountant, they both said the same thing. They said, Steve, you are in the right. You know, they owe you money, but just pay it because it's going to cost you more money in court to challenge this than just pay it. So most people just pay these fines and the auditing costs because they don't want to tangle with an all powerful IRS. This is an abusive agency. Remember when the left, you know, Dan, when we were little, the left cared about civil liberties and the abuses that took place. Now they don't care. They don't care about that.
Yeah.
Because you don't share their same opinion, so they want to destroy you.
Your story is what the left calls the rule of law these days. It's just a shakedown operation. Exactly right. Yep. Steve Moore, economist, author of Trumponomics and Govzilla, most recently. Steve, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Have a great week. Take care.
You too. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Do you enjoy quiet, Amy?
I love quiet time.
You know why you do?
Because I'm sick of noise.
Because you're a white supremacist.
Hey.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a form of meditation, being alone and being quiet with your thoughts.
Yeah. Maybe for a privileged honky like yourself. Sochil Gonzalez writing in The Atlantic. Why do rich people love quiet? The sound of gentrification is silence. I'm not going to go full Garfunkel on you here, but
please don't.
She writes, New York in the summer is a noisy place, especially if you don't have money. The rich run off to the Hamptons or Maine. The bourgeois are safely shielded by the hum of their central air. Their petite cousins. Petite?
Petite.
Cousins. Why do they have to be petite? Okay. By the roar of their window units. But for the broke, the little or the have littles and have nots. Summer means an open window through which the clatter of the city becomes the soundtrack to life. Motorcycles revving, buses braking, couples squabbling, children summoning one another to play, and music, ceaseless music. Yeah, well, maybe that's why nobody
that
wants
here.
To live there.
Right.
I remember, and this is where it gets good. I remember the summer before I left for college, lying close to my bedroom Bach fan, taking it all in. Thanks to a partial scholarship, I was on my way to an Ivy League college. Oh, the humanity of this life she's leading.
Should we start a GoFundMe page?
I was counting down the days, eager to ditch the concrete sidewalks in my family's cramped railroad apartment and start living life on my own terms against a backdrop of lush manicured lawns and stately architecture. I didn't yet know that you don't live on an Ivy League campus.
You what?
you reside on one.
She has suffered.
Living is loud and messy.
Yes. Residing.
But residing? Residing in quiet business. She first arrived on campus for the minority student orientation, did Miss Gonzalez. Had the feel of a block party.
Is that what she said?
Yeah. Spent the first... By the way, this is in the 90s, so she's writing this as, you know, let's say, I don't know, a 35, 40 to 45-year-old or something. 40 to 50-year-old. We spent those first few nights convening in one another's rooms, gossiping, dancing until late. Then, you know what happened?
The regular students came and ruined it all.
And by regular...
You mean the white people.
Then the other students arrived, the white students.
And it was...
Honkies like you came, and everything was ruined. The first day of classes marked by such gloriously waspy pomp, it made my young aspirational heart leap. Professors in academic regalia gave speeches about century-old traditions and how wonderful and unique we were, the best class yet, and... so on and so forth, a cappella groups and whatnot. It was like an episode of Glee, my parenthetical remark. I just hadn't counted on everything that followed being so quiet. The hush crept up on me at first. I'd be hanging out with my friends from orientation when one of our new roommates would start ostentatiously readying themselves for bed at a surprisingly early hour. Hints would be taken. Eyes would be rolled. We'd call it a night. One day, when I accidentally sat down to study in the library's absolutely quiet room, fellow students shushed me into shame for putting on my Discman. So this is some time ago. With rare exceptions, like Saturday nights during rush, silence blanketed the campus. I soon realized that silence was more than an absence of noise. It was an aesthetic to be revered. Yet it was an aesthetic at odds with who I was, who a lot of us were. And it just goes on from there with the tortured existence on the Ivy League campus, having to be quiet in quiet spaces. And you wonder why.
Quiet.
You wonder why people are fleeing these and encouraging people to flee these hallowed halls of academia. You also can no longer be curious as to how those institutions have become what they are. And how the institutions filled with the graduates of those institutions have become what they are. For more on this, since he's written about Karens recently, and we're talking a lot about them, David Marcus, columnist living in New York City, author of Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
So in New York, David, would you say you live or you reside?
Well, that's a deep philosophical question.
It really is.
If I can just put a cherry on top of this story for you, I don't know if you guys saw this. I just saw it this morning. Apparently, Gonzalez, over the last year or two, wrote a piece for Elle magazine, the like fashion magazine, about how when the pandemic started, she was living in Brooklyn with some friends, and one of the things she describes in this piece is that there were so many sirens and it got so loud in New York City during this time that she couldn't work. So what she did was she rented a house that summer in Kingston, New York, in the Hudson Valley. I'm not making this up. I swear to God.
She wanted quiet.
Not a joke, man. Yeah. She needed white supremacist silence.
Yes, exactly.
So she went to the Hudson Valley so she could get her work done. Look, it's ridiculous. I mean, I'm about as white as somebody can get. I've lived in New York City for 20 years. Yeah, it's loud, right? Like when I go someplace, my dad used to have a farm and I'd go out there and I had a hard time. It's like my son, when he was a baby, if we would go there, would have a hard time sleeping because it was too quiet because he was used to his room being right on Manhattan Avenue in Greenpoint. Like, this is just insanity. I mean, these people can literally point at anything and say it's a result of racism and white supremacy. Anything.
Speaking of insanity, I liked your piece and the reference. Quite the man of letters, a Flaubert reference. I necessarily expect that from people who write about policy and politics and culture these days. But anyway, your piece about Flaubert's Dictionary of Received Ideas, and I mean, give us an example. I don't want to steal your thunder here. There's some good ones in this piece.
Oh, I know my favorite.
By the way, I still like Ambrose Bierce's Devil's Dictionary better than Flaubert's Dictionary of Received Ideas, but this is good too. So, David, what is a woman in the Dictionary of Received Ideas 2022 version?
I mean, I don't have the piece directly in front of me, but I believe what I wrote was something along the lines of a woman is an adult human being who either believes or states that they are female. That there is no physical characteristic that can be used at any time to determine whether or not somebody is a woman. We saw this obviously with Justice Ketanji Brown, who refused to define what a woman is. I think it was Josh Hawley who had the back and forth over the word mother with right. one of the witnesses. And obviously the example of woman is at odds with 40,000 years. Of human understanding. The Democrats are, we just saw what they did with the word recession. We thought we knew what that meant. Apparently we didn't, right? And now what a recession is some really complicated, you have to take all of these variables into account, and it's way too complicated for us to understand. We just have to trust the experts. But the one thing we know is that it'll never be a recession while a Democrat is
president. Yes, right. Hey. Wait, just on the woman definition, I just want to
fix that last line.
Yeah, you're right. There exists no physical way to describe any unique attributes to women's bodies, unless you're discussing abortion.
Oh yeah, no. If the topic is abortion, that goes right out the window, and they can't define the word woman fast enough.
I also think Flaubert's Dictionary of Received Ideas is relevant today. So is his most famous work, which is Madame Bovary. Living beyond your means in a society you find tedious and banal. That's what we have going on here, too.
Oh, I think that we do. And I think that, I've been writing about, and I'm writing a piece today, and I'm thinking a lot about sort of urban spaces and urban planning. Like there's no police is the key, right? But there's other things that we can do in our cities and even our suburbs and rural areas to promote, sort of better behavior and just to get people together, right? Like people don't go to church anymore. They don't have the lodge. They don't have the bowling league. One of the things about those places is they weren't super expensive. Now everything that people do is sort of shopping online or subscribing to something and a lot of the stuff they're doing alone. And even without inflation, that's getting really expensive. And I think, what I grew up with, when I was in my 20s and 30s, where there were a lot of really inexpensive options where people could just go hang out and have a good time together. I worry that, my son's generation is not going to have that because it's all disappearing.
Yeah. Like we used to have roller rinks or, dance clubs, yeah. Things like that. They're non-existent.
Dungeons and Dragons clubs.
Oh, that's what you
said. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
For yourself on that one.
I am.
But I loved your definition of insurrection. I know you don't have the piece in front of you, but you said a violent attempt to disrupt the usual practice of government by a group pursuing the overthrow of said government. This, of course, does not apply to attacks on federal buildings in Portland, for which the term mostly peaceful protest is best suited.
Oh, yeah. I mean, exactly. Because if you're setting a federal building on fire for good, just progressive reasons, that's righteous civil disobedience. If you're a January 6th rioter, then, you're going to go to jail for years and years. You're going to sit in jail even before you have your trial. So, I was trying to be a little funny with that one, but it's actually not funny because having that kind of two-tier justice system is something that Americans really, really need to be afraid of. And I say that as somebody who thought what happened on the Capitol on January 6th was absolutely horrible. But that's not an excuse for having two different systems of justice.
Going back to what you're talking about people getting together, face-to-face, not to play video games across the world. You talk about where things are with respect to COVID in New York now, finally, and sort of that COVID is over in New York. But is it? I mean, isn't Eric Adams still firing people who are non-vaccine mandate compliant and still talking about vaccine mandates for kids to return to school?
He is. He had pledged to not mandate vaccines for kids in public schools. He kind of walked that back. That was while he was running. He's now walked that back a little and says, you know, says that he's considering it. You know, I really hope that he doesn't. But yeah, our political leadership is still a mess, and it's why it's really important to keep an eye on this governor's race.
Yeah.
We have Congressman Lee Zeldin,
yeah,
who's running against Kathy Hochul, who was, of course, Cuomo's replaced Cuomo once he resigned in disgrace. So if he can pull out a win, and I don't think it's impossible, that would really help. But I think for the population, it's mostly over. I think in that, it might have been in that piece I mentioned recently, I was a witness for a friend's wedding at Borough Hall in Brooklyn. And I got up to the door, it's like a government building, and they were like, oh, you have to put a mask on. I hadn't thought about that in 2 months. I didn't have, you know, they had one for me, but, you know, and now it's like, sometimes I'll put on a suit that I haven't worn in a while. You know, this will happen, and you reach in the pocket, and there's like a ticket stub from 5 months ago. And you're like, oh, I remember that. That's what finding the mask is like.
Yeah, right.
You know, you reach in your pocket, you're like, oh, my God, this thing.
Yeah.
So demographics, you know, there's some demographics at work here, too, right? The people most likely to be masked right now in New York City are Asian immigrants. But a lot of Asian immigrants were wearing masks before COVID. So that's right. That's kind of a cultural thing. That's a little bit of an outlier for the most part. And I'm curious if it's the same in Chicago. I see almost no masks outside, and even on the subway and in Lyft or Ubers or whatever, they're increasingly rare.
Yeah. I'd say there's some, but I think they're pretty rare, especially outside.
No,
They're rare enough to be noticeable.
Every day, listen to this. Every day I drive to work, there's some dude and I want to pull over my car and just ask him what is wrong with him. Walking by himself at 4 a.m. on Addison Street, and he has a mask on.
Yeah, but those are anecdotes. I mean, they're not. It's not nearly. I think it's pretty rare, and also too, just a cultural difference in terms of who is tolerant and who is not. You know, I had a lot of people feel compelled to tell me to put a mask on during the height of the mask mandate. You know, I see people walking around. I see people driving alone in a car, walking out by themselves on the sidewalk, like you said, Amy. And I haven't felt compelled to interfere with their life and tell them what I think of whether or not they should wear a mask. But maybe that's just me. I don't know.
I feel that way too, Dan. But there's another part of me, because, yeah, I'm not going to go up to somebody and say, like, you know,
you're an
what
idiot.
Are you doing?
Yeah.
Right. But there is a part of me that worries if a significant portion of the population continues to do this, that it does have an effect on quality of life, right? The same way we talk about kids need to be able to see the faces of their teachers.
Yeah.
Back to that notion of us all living in a space together and communing with each other. If we can't see each other's faces, it just fundamentally changes what living in society is like. So, you know, I do wish that fewer people would be doing it, but I'm with you that, like, I'm not going to do what they did and start, you know, harassing strangers.
Right. I mean, I agree with what your point about that, but I just think for me, the people who I don't want to talk to and the people wearing masks, that Venn diagram is a perfect circle.
Yeah, there's a real
yeah,
there's a real over. And I think the airports are a great test, and planes,
yes,
are a great test for the broader national take on this, because Fauci is still telling people wear masks on the plane, wear masks on the in the airport. And from what I've seen and what others have written, very few people are doing that.
He is David Marcus, columnist living in NYC, author of Charade, The COVID Lies That Crushed a Nation. Pick it up. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
It's Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we've talked quite a bit this morning, as we do on many days, have to, unfortunately, talk about public safety in Chicago and Illinois and throughout the rest of the nation, as big cities and a lot of mid-sized cities over the last 3 years have decided to allow their communities to descend into lawlessness. And Chicago is obviously one of the more pronounced cases of that. But this against the backdrop of the Supreme Court decision in the New York case, which states clearly that the right to carry outside of one's home, the right to protect them oneself outside of one's home, that individual right is guaranteed under the Second Amendment. And so while there are concerns about vigilante justice incidents occurring because of the lack of civilian support, civilian political support for police in so many of these big cities because of these leftist politicians. Nonetheless, people, it's one of those things that is often said, whether you want to be ultimately held to provide for your own defense or not, it's possible that you will be, and you should be prepared. And so how do you get prepared? Such as in a way that if you're not familiar with guns, that you get familiar, you demystify the instrument, and you're comfortable in a crisis setting protecting yourself or others, the way we saw that young man save so many lives outside that mall in Greenwood, Indiana, just a couple of weeks ago. Well, to help us answer those questions, we're pleased to be joined by Austin Davis, National Training Director for Conceal Coalition. He has more than 30 years' experience in law enforcement and law enforcement training. Austin Davis, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you say to the novice, to the student that comes to one of your classes? I don't know anything about guns. I'm scared of guns. I don't like guns, maybe even, but I feel like I need to know how to use a gun, and I want to get comfortable. I want to understand they're at least open-minded and thoughtful enough to be pursuing an education. What's your message to them, to that person?
My first message is that would be my dream student, somebody who comes to me, because my first question wouldn't be about the gun. It'd be about the why. We'll get to the how later. Why do you want the gun? If they say, I want to be safer, then my advice is let's not even talk about the gun. Forget about the gun now. Let's think about security and personal safety in a holistic approach. Let's think about it from the first instance we have a realization that something in our life is about to go criminally wrong with an attack to that last piece of paper is being signed off in the courts. We focus too much on the gun. This gun is just a tiny part of a whole self-defense issue. So the first thing is we want to know why. Who are those five people in your life that you will literally die for or go to prison to save? Who are those people you're committed to protecting always, be a guardian always, and a warrior when needed? And then let's work from that perspective on.
Mm-hmm. And so, a little bit more than on that. Somebody says, you know, I live in Chicago, and I don't want to be afraid anymore. That's why I'm here. What do you say to them? I mean, the gun's a little piece of it, but then when you talk about it holistically, what are the component parts that somebody needs to learn? What are the modules in the training?
Well, I want you to think about it for a second. A gun is a very limited tool. You know, it is designed to save human life, not injure innocent life, and be the last resort. So, you know, first off, we need to talk to them about being aware, not paranoid, but aware, how to read the baseline, things that are above and below the baseline. You know, we want to talk about de-escalation training, but more importantly, something no one else really focuses on but us, which is not escalating the situation training. You need to understand use of force. You know, when is it time to talk? When is it time to have less lethal? Because in many situations, it's a simple assault, and a gun may not be the perfect tool. And if you do have to go to the gun, we have to teach the mechanics of grip, sight, trigger control, how to hold the gun, how to draw the gun, but more importantly, how to deal with a 911 phone call, how to deal with the police, how to deal with the legal fight after the fight. This is a whole topic. And just to focus on the gun may end up putting them in a worse situation than better. And I know this sounds weird coming from a quote-unquote gun guy, but this is a safety issue. It's not a tool issue.
Mm-hmm. On the law enforcement side, your training with law enforcement or training of law enforcement, What is that like? What are those conversations like in this environment where, you know, every instance of use of force is a potential? I mean, it always has been a potential career ender, but it's there's much greater antagonism. There's a much greater desire to see any use of force be a career ender or a criminal prosecution when it pertains to the police.
It's an interesting question, especially for me. I'm third generation law enforcement, and I went into law enforcement and got a badge many, many years ago. I left to leave to go to corporate crime training. And then when COVID hit, I came back out on the streets after a long layoff. What's interesting is all my relatives are out. They used to think I was crazy for leaving. Now they think I'm crazy for being in. The situation in day-to-day law enforcement, after my absence coming back to it, is a unique perspective that scares me. Number one, almost all the veteran officers are either gone or they're vertical retirees. They're just answering calls and not just really protecting their own self. We have a group of young officers coming in who don't have those mentors to help them into the process. This is a very unusual profession. We have personnel staffing, so that means we have to get those baby officers out and in a car by themselves just for coverage. 911 system is crashing because we don't have enough 911 operators, and they take forever to train to be competent. They're the unsung heroes in this whole emergency. But now we have another layer. That is the supply chain problems. We can't get new cars. We can't get our cars repaired. We're having a hard time finding the type of tires we need to respond to vehicles. My personal radio is so messed up, I have to turn it off and reboot it every time I communicate, and there are no other radios in supply chain. So these are issues. And this, of course, shows up in a lot longer holding times or not response at all when these people call in to 911.
What police department are you with?
I'm with a small agency in Texas.
Okay.
And with respect to police specifically, just sticking on police, what are the concerns that you mentioned? What are proactive police departments that do have the support of the civilian political leadership? What do you see them doing to address maybe the material support, the cars and radios and stuff? Setting that aside for a second, but culture, what do you see them doing to make law enforcement responsible and trusted in the local community, but also law enforcement, you know, enforcing the laws and removing people from the streets that have demonstrated that they shouldn't be free on the streets?
Well, it's demoralizing for us because right now, as I speak to my brothers and sisters in blue all over the country, so much of this is catch and release. You know, it's almost as if by the time we put them in a jail cell, they're released back on the streets before we can even finish the paperwork. So for a lot of us, we feel like, what's the point of even arresting them? Some of the communities have a real problem with low-level offenders where the district attorney will just sort of say, well, we're just not going to enforce that crime. And, you know, if you can't get lower levels. And it's demoralizing in places like Chicago where there's a foot pursuit policy now so that, you know, you can't chase them if they run away. And it's a hard thing for an officer to wrap their head around. You know, you find bad person runs, you don't chase them. And, you know, this really restricts an officer's effectiveness. This makes the criminals a lot more bold. And it's just another layer of training and programming for officers so they can stay in policy. These are all things that are just really, really make a difficult job even more difficult.
Back to the training aspect of it. When you're dealing with women, what kind of weapon do you recommend that they use? Because believe it or not, our hands are made differently than man's hands.
One of those AK-15s that Indianapolis Colts general manager Chris Ballard was talking about, whatever that is. I mean, that's got to be the thing. Sorry to interrupt Amy's question, but that's got to be the thing that's frustrating too. In these gun debates, is how many people don't know the first thing about what they're talking about, but have, you know, profile based on their jobs to opine on gun control and AK-15s and so forth.
Well, it's an interesting topic, and there's a term for it which eludes me right now, but basically anytime you're on the news media and you see a report on something you have intimate knowledge of or level of expertise and you go, they got that completely wrong, that's goofy, then the next story you go, well, they must know what they're talking about. But if you were an expert on that level, you probably know as well. It's frustrating to me because, you know, it is part of our Constitution. It's the second part of the Constitution, Bill of Rights, to have a firearm. Now, again, this sounds strange coming from a, quote, gun guy, but I think gun ownership is our right, but training and education is our responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you can have a gun doesn't mean you know how to use it. I have a guitar in my closet, but I have no clue on how to use it. Ownership does not equate to competency. So I'm real big about, yes, you have the right to have it, but it's your personal individual responsibility. And when it comes to gender-specific guns and training issues, it's so you really can't give a here's a woman's gun and here's a man's gun, because all hands are the same, but they're very different. Some people have pre-existing conditions where their grip strength's off. Some people have bigger hands than others. Some people aren't committed to having a larger gun that's easier to shoot. Some people have such large hands and such large stature, a tiny gun might be difficult. So it's a lot more complicated than if you're in this category, you need this, and if you're in that category, you need that. Because remember, there's only two rules in my world for a concealed carry gun. Number one, in a gunfight, bring the gun, or you're not in a gunfight, you're in a shooting, much different life experience. And number two, if it hurts, awkward, or uncomfortable to carry, or it doesn't fit your lifestyle, you won't have the gun when you need it. So it has to fit into your hand, your lifestyle, your ability to carry it, your ability to store it safely.
Yeah, Amy prefers the
Beretta.
The 88 Magnum, the Johnny Dangerously gun. So, all right. Also,
Amy, I've never met you, but I already like you.
Yeah. Oh, you love me if you met me. We'd be besties.
Yeah. She's looking at being a mercenary in a second career, doing combat missions. Austin, tell us about then. So Conceal Coalition is the business. And I know you have training classes, speaking of education and training classes in the Chicagoland area. So tell us a little bit about your business, the type of classes you offer, and where you offer them in the Chicagoland region.
Well, Conceal Coalition, Chicago is like our number two market. We've done about 113,000 students online and in person since we became an organization. Since the Highland Park tragedy, that number is up 138%. Chicago's number two. New York is number one in gun training demands. So we offer three levels. We offer the state mandated class. We have something called Conceal Coalition University, which is a comprehensive online training program, which teaches you those skill sets in a way that helps adults better retain it in that part of the head that works in a crisis. And we also have the virtual reality, Conceal Coalition Virtual Tactical Academy, which is a virtual reality shooting school, because in my world, everything needs to be trained in scenario based. So that you can actually put it, you know, it's really hard when you silo-based train someone, say, here's how you shoot a gun. But then all of a sudden we go, when is this imminent and you need to use the weapon? When is this verbal? When is this less lethal? And you don't have a way to combine all that training. So just the same way we train fighter pilots or airline pilots in a simulator, we think civilians who have firearms need to be trained in a simulator. I've been doing this around the country for about 11 years now.
That's cool. The simulator thing that's cool. I like that wrinkle. The just one thing, Highland Park, since the Highland Park massacre, 138% increase in students in Chicagoland. That's really interesting because, of course, the debate, if you think this is the only debate, if you only watch the news, you would think this is the only debate about whether or not to move forward with some sort of sport rifle ban in Illinois. And in point of fact, you just have a lot of law-abiding people that quietly take classes and now want to protect themselves and want to be able to respond in a crisis the way that kid did in Greenwood, Indiana, that I mentioned. Green, you know, outside the mall in Greenwood, Indiana. So it's also to just the distortion that's created by the media in terms of what is important to people and the actions that people are taking in the wake of whether it's a massacre like that in a parade or it's just the massacres that happen on the streets of Chicago every weekend.
Well, I would break that down into two branches. One is, I think because of the state of law enforcement right now and the state of the increasing crime rate, that people need to train to be their own first responder. Check that box, got that. The next thing we have to do, though, is whether you're pro-gun or anti-gun, we have to address the mental health issues. You know, we can say, let's take away a modern sporting rifle and it'll solve the problem. You know, we had Wisconsin this weekend on the Apple River where people were floating down in tubes, mm-hmm. where a 53-year-old man came out with a knife and there was a death and four injuries from that. Norway last month, we had some guy who was under duress, who came into a grocery store with a bow and arrow, 26 arrows and four knives, and injured five people. So, you know, there's a knife situation and a bow and a knife situation. In the 1950s, we had about 350 mental health beds, full-time patient beds per 100,000. Today, that number is about 17%. As a police officer, when I come to your house and you called me, the reason you called me is because your family member was in crisis. You, the closest person that that individual could not handle if you called law enforcement. In my situation, I only have one mental health facility. That's called the county jail. And so we need to rethink the mental health issue. It's not easy, and it's something we all need to agree on. It goes past the firearm thing.
He is Austin Davis. He's the National Training Director for Concealed Coalition. ConcealedCoalition.com is the site with all the information on their classes, trainings that they do. Austin has more than 30 years experience in law enforcement and law enforcement training. Austin Davis, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.